Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the elections in Tunisia that could be a harbinger of democratic change as the Arab Spring bears fruit in a country where the revolution sweeping the Middle East began. Veteran BBC journalist Roger Hardy joins us. He has been a Middle East and Islamic Affairs analyst with the BBC's World Service for 20 years and is the author of The Muslim Revolt, A Journey Through Political Islam. As well as the regional implications, we will discuss the victory of the Islamists in Tunisia and whether they will keep their promise to respect the secular traditions of this comparatively liberal North African country. Then we will talk about our neighbor to the south, Mexico, the author of a new book, El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency, joins us. We will discuss the increasingly violent and grisly criminal insurgency that poses the greatest armed threat to Mexico since the 1910 revolution, an insurgency which so far has resulted in 40,000 murders south of the border in a failed war on drugs that is fueled by money and guns from the U.S. Joining us now is Roger Hardy, who has been a Middle East and Islamic Affairs analyst with the BBC World Service for the last 20 years. He is currently a visiting fellow at the London School of Economics and is the author of The Muslim Revolt, A Journey Through Political Islam. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Hardy.
Thanks very much.
And the elections in Tunisia have yet to be decided. The country's Independent Election Commission, known by the acronym ISIE, for reasons I'm not entirely clear about, seem to be very slow with the count. But at this point, there are 81 seats out of the 217-seat Constituent Assembly have been decided, with Al Nahda, the moderate Islamist party, having won 35 seats. And then the Congress Party with 13, Arida Chabia with 10, Etta Katal with 9, and the Progressive Democratic Party with 4. And already apparently the centre-left party, Etta Katal, is in negotiations with the moderate Islamist Al Nahda Party, which has claimed more than 40% of the seats. So that's the latest information I have. Do you have anything more up to date than that?
That sounds right, and I think it shows that the Islamists have received more votes than anybody else, which is pretty much what we expected, but not a majority, and so they're having to form what they're calling a government of national unity, and hence the coalition talks that, as you say, seem to be already underway.
And the leader of the Islamist party, Al Nahda, Rashid Ghannouchi, this has got to be a huge victory for him, having returned after 22 years of exile and at this point winning 40% of the vote.
It's a great triumph for him. He's a former school teacher, and when he spent more than 20 years in exile in London, I, like many other journalists here, went to see him. I think there's not much doubt that his Islamist opinions have mellowed over the years, and I think it's for that reason that his party now is routinely described as a moderate Islamist party. Now, what does that mean? It means that they're putting the democratic aspect first and the Islamic aspect second. They want to be a democratic party for all Tunisians, but at the same time a party that respects the values of Islam, but at the same time they would be very quick to say those values include tolerance and they include women's rights. I think one of the big tests will be whether they can overcome the mistrust that a large number of middle-class Tunisians feel towards them.
Well, already there's talk from those very quarters, Roger Hardy, of a double discourse between the party line and the more radical rank and file, differences between the moderate discourse of the party's leaders and the more conservative party activists on the ground. It does seem that in the poor inner city and rural areas, the party did well.
I think that's the case, and I think it's at least possible that Ghannouchi is more progressive than some of his own party members. Large parties like this, even when they've had to exist underground for a large number of years, as they did under President Ben Ali, nevertheless are a kind of coalition between more moderate Islamists who are ready to live and let live with other Tunisians, and more radical Muslims who have a very conservative view of their religion and a very conservative view of women's rights, for example. So I think part of the test is whether Ghannouchi, who is now 70 years old, I mean, he's very well regarded, he's revered. Tunisians call him the Sheikh, which is revering his old age as well as his Islamic learning, but whether he can really show the leadership skills, the political bargaining skills, to keep the show on the road as they enter what is going to be, without doubt, a very difficult transition away from dictatorship towards something better.
Well, obviously, the big challenge is unemployment, which is pervasive with the young throughout the Arab world. Al-Nader's promised 590,000 new jobs over 5 years and to cut unemployment to 8.5%. I don't think even an American politician would make those kind of claims.
It's a very big promise, and I think that was very important for a lot of the voters, especially the younger voters. Youth unemployment is extremely high in Tunisia, as it is in many of these Arab countries, where people under 30 are 60, 70, sometimes even more than 70% of the population. So people wanted to believe that they're a democratic party. I think politics is the main driver here, but at the same time, if they get a government in that's more democratic, less corrupt, pledged to try and get rid of corruption and the kind of crony capitalism associated with the old regime, at the same time, they're going to have to show that they're technically competent, that they have the technocrats within their ranks who can bring about real economic change for a population whose expectations are extremely high. A lot of Tunisians, just like Egyptians further along the coast in Egypt, wanted to believe that once the dictator had gone, their lives would get better in some material sense. Now it hasn't. The economy has got worse in most of these countries. Tunisia, like Egypt, relies on tourism, and there's no way international tourists are going to come to a country that's going through a very turbulent political phase. So it's going to take a while to get some of those tourists back, and they may not come back in the same numbers that they were there before. So all of that amounts to a huge economic and social challenge for the new leaders of the country.
Well, of course, the Europeans themselves are not exactly out of the woods in terms of their economic health, and that would indicate probably a downturn in tourism, no matter what the destination might be. Again, I'm speaking with Roger Hardy, who has been a Middle East and Islamic Affairs analyst with the BBC World Service for the last 20 years. He is currently a visiting fellow at the London School of Economics and is the author of The Muslim Revolt, A Journey Through Political Islam. This election, of course, is, I think, the first democratic election in the Middle East, North Africa, Arab world, if you will. I guess the last one would be in 2006 in the Palestinian elections that brought Hamas into power and split the Palestinians. What about its significance? Obviously, we've just had a third Arab dictator removed from power next door in Libya. You've got a fourth stubbornly holding on to power in Yemen. and a fifth in Syria seems to prepare to continue to massacre his own people indefinitely as long as he can hold on to power. It's a pretty grim prognosis. How much is this hopeful sign going to change the dynamics, do you think, Roger Hardy?
I think the symbolic power of it is enormous. Tunisia already had the symbolic power of being the place where this all began back in December of last year when this young man, this market trader, set fire to himself as an act of protest and against the authorities. Now Tunisia has, as it were, the double acclaim, the double kudos of being the place that, where the first free election has happened since this Arab Spring got underway. Now, those things are symbolic, but at the same time, they will give, they will boost the morale of activists and democracy movements elsewhere. Now, to go back to your question, will it by itself change the dynamics of the region? No, I don't think so. And I think in some ways, Tunisia has always had, from the beginning of this whole affair, advantages that some of the other countries, including Egypt, by the way, do not have. The fact that it's small, that it has an educated population by the standards of the region, that it has a tradition of tolerance by the standards of the region, and even the fact that it is very close to Europe, just across the water, all those things, at least to a degree, act in its favor as they embark on this, what will undoubtedly be a very difficult transition in the months and years ahead. So the Tunisians are starting from a better place, I think, than Egypt, and a far better place than Libya, where there's also been regime change, as we all know, and now the death of Gaddafi. And if you compare Tunisia with this very grim situation in Syria and Yemen, the places where there is the most violence at the moment as regimes cling stubbornly to power, well, in that comparison, Tunisia is light years away. But this election, including, by the way, the fact that the Islamist party has done better than anybody else, will, I think, encourage a lot of people in Arab countries, regardless of the situation in those particular countries, to believe that if you go on protesting, even against a dictator who's ready to use a lot of violence against you, you can, in the end, achieve something.
And what about, Roger Hardy, though, the message of encouragement to other Islamist parties? We have the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, who have essentially, when the revolution started, it was largely started by the liberals who... essentially, the ruling military junta have tried to diminish their influence, make sort of secret deals with the Brotherhood, and you know, this violence against the cops has to some extent put the military on trial there. They don't seem to want to leave. But is there something to be learned from the Tunisian example, and that is that in these countries, in the with high unemployment and in the poor inner city and rural areas, people simply will vote for God. And that will likely happen in Libya, and it will likely happen in Egypt.
I think that's broadly true, but I think there are some differences which are of some importance. I think the leadership of the Egyptian a party, the Muslim Brotherhood, the leadership is more conservative than Ghannouchi in Tunisia. I think it's a crusty old reactionary leadership in Egypt, which frustrates some of the young Muslim activists who went to Tahrir Square and joined forces with the younger, more nationalistic, more secular folk with their mobile phones and their Facebook pages and so on. So I think that conservative leadership in the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt is one distinct feature that they have. I think the other that's very important is that the military has played a different role in Egypt. In Tunisia, the key thing in getting rid of Ben Ali was when the military withdrew support for him and said, we're not going to kill Tunisians to keep you in power. And at that point, the military very largely withdrew from the scene. In Egypt, it was almost the opposite. The military intervened to end the standoff in Tahrir Square, that extraordinary dramatic period of days. And they were the ones who forced Mubarak out and brought the Tahrir Square protests to an end. Initially, Egyptian Democrats and activists welcomed this, but now they're very suspicious that the military simply wants to hang on, preserve its own power, even if there are elections later on, and there are due to be elections there in Egypt next month, but that the military somehow will engineer things to preserve their own power in the country and to preserve the very important perks and privileges which go with that power. So I'm not totally pessimistic about the Egyptian case, but I think the Tunisians have more going for them right now. I think they've got off to an earlier start than anybody else, and that conditions are on the whole more favorable in Tunisia than they are elsewhere.
Well, just in closing, Roger Hardy, there have apparently been reports that Islamist fundamentalists in Tunisia burned down at least 3 brothels after Ben Ali fell. And as you were saying earlier, this is Tunisia has a fairly secular and liberal tradition. It's more European than most of the Arab countries. Now, the Al Nahda has promised not to touch the Tunisian legal code, which outlaws polygamy, mandates women's approval to get married, limits the power of men in divorce, legalized abortion, etc. Pretty much unheard of anywhere else in the Arab world. Would that be a litmus test to watch?
Very much so. I think one of the problems for the Islamist party of Ghannouchi is that there are other Islamists, usually described as Salafis very close to the kind of Wahhabi Islam of Saudi Arabia. And it was probably them that have been attacking the cinemas when there was a film they didn't like, or attacking the brothels or places where alcohol is served. It is worth noting that Ghannouchi has condemned the use of violence. He's condemned intolerance when these incidents have taken place. But now is when the real test begins. First of all, the test of whether the Islamists can work in tandem with more secular nationalistic parties in a government of national unity. That's not going to be easy. And whether their actions will reassure that educated Tunisian middle class, as well as reassuring the country's Western allies. The guy's words are good. He talks the talk. But can they actually achieve the kind of national unity they're talking about? And can they solve the country's extremely pressing problems? The road ahead is going to be long. It's going to be rough.
Well, just a quick last thought, though. Won't this isolate Algeria even further, given the path of reform that's going on in Tunisia and next door in Libya, and the Algerian regime basically supported Gaddafi and his sons, and his family have taken refuge there. We know that they, after 20 years ago, they nullified an election where the Islamists won, and that led to decades of unbelievable brutality. What's your prognosis on the Arab Spring affecting Algeria?
Algeria, at least so far, has been the dog that didn't bark. It's true there were some protests in the early months of this year, but since then, very little. And this is, on the face of it, pretty surprising, because Algeria has all the problems that are very familiar in these Arab countries now. A young population, an unpopular and corrupt and authoritarian regime that's made up of both civilian and military elements. You'd have thought Algeria was ripe for protest and demonstration. I think the break on all of that is actually quite simple. The country went through hell in the 1990s for pretty much a decade, with violence between different armed Islamic groups and the security forces, a kind of dirty war in which everybody played the game in a dirty way. Huge numbers of Algerians were killed, anything between 100,000 and 200,000. Algerians look at one another and say, we're not going to risk going back to all of that again. And if we take to the streets again, even though we have plenty of grievances, we'll run the risk of a rerun of those terrible events. They just don't want to go there.
Well, I thank you for joining us here, Roger Hardy. It's been an interesting conversation. Again, I've been speaking with Roger Hardy, who has been a Middle East and Islamic Affairs analyst with the BBC World Service for the last 20 years. He is currently a visiting fellow at the London School of Economics and is author of The Muslim Revolt, A Journey Through Political Islam. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment.